This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
This is our league, and this is your league. Broadcasting from the 55-yard line in Japan to the shores of the Great White North and everywhere around the world on Gridiron America Radio and the Sports History Network.
Buddy, it is Greg St. James here at the Gridiron Japan podcast, and this is also a simulcast on Gridiron America Radio. Both podcasts are now available on the Sports History Network. Both Gridiron Japan, Gridiron America, both members of the Sports History Network. And in that vein, in the inauguration of being on the Sports History Network, there was only one guest I knew I had to get, and that is Upton Bell. Man, Upton, thank you very much for joining me today here to sit down. And for those who are listening who don't know who Upton Bell is or why he's on, you're probably pretty young, or you haven't read a history book. So Upton is the son of former NFL commissioner Burt Bell. Burt Bell was the commissioner before Pete Rozelle, and Burt Bell is also the one who inaugurated the NFL draft, which is going to be happening here in the next 10 days. So Upton, with all that said, welcome. It's great to see you, my old friend, and you and I have talked on many occasions. Thank you for sitting down with me from where you're at there in Boston.
Well, I have to tell you, welcome Japan too, because I took a trip to China and Japan, and Japan's one of the countries I absolutely loved. And actually, I was going to China, glad to get out of China at the time. This is back in the middle 80s. Went on to Japan, loved Tokyo, Kyoto, a lot of Japan, loved the people. So to Japan, great for all of you. I might also add to it about Burt Bell, Greg, is that he founded the Philadelphia Eagles and then later became a co-owner with Art Rooney of the Steelers.
They kind of franchised
it, and they never figured it out. But the interesting thing is, as more and more people call me every day, figuring out, well, somewhere along the line, this guy's going to be gone. We need to get the information. And basically, if it wasn't for my mother, Frances Upton, who I'm named after, if it wasn't for her saying to my father, they met at a party in New York at a party, I think, for Charles Lindbergh. I'm not name dropping.
Really?
And at that time, Frances Upton was engaged to one of the richest young men in America, Bernard Baruch, who was President Roosevelt's major financial advisor. His son was engaged to my mother. She met my father at this party, you know, he was the playboy of the Western world. This was well before the Eagles and the Steelers.
Yeah.
He said something like, "Hey, honey, why don't you come to Philly sometime and we'll have a good time?" She said, "First of all, don't call me honey." And she said, "Secondly, I don't date people who drink." And so long story short, a year or so later, she was the one that really, she loved the Bears. I mean, Frances Upton, Ziegfeld Follies, look it up, your audience. She was one of the great stories on Ziegfeld Follies. And so she was well known. She was much more well known than Burt Bell. And she said, you know, they would take the Follies on the road. They go to Chicago. They go everywhere, particularly Chicago. She said, you know what? She said, you ever see the Chicago Bears? You ever see Red Grange and George Halas and all of these people? And she said, forget college football. That, you know, no comparison to the pros. So they actually, she broke her engagement to Baruch. And I've often said to her many times, I said, what the hell did you do that for? That guy had a lot of money. my father's father supported him through a lot of bad times that he had financially. And she said, she started to date him, and they went to the Penn games at Franklin Field. She would come down to Philadelphia. She had broken her engagement.
Yeah.
And I think they dated off and on for a year. But when it came time, the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets were up for sale. They had all sorts of problems into bankruptcy, although they had won the NFL championship, I think, 2 or 3 years earlier. And basically, he and another partner decided to go buy them out of bankruptcy. Where was he going to get the money? His father wasn't going to give him the money. My mother gave him the money. Without Frances Upton, there's no Eagles, there's no there's the Steelers, and there's no NFL draft.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. That's a butterfly effect that never happened.
It's unbelievable, that part of the story. And actually, when Burt Bell's statue was erected at Franklin Field in Philadelphia 2 years ago, I got up. The commissioner actually sent a tape and talked about Burt Bell, and there were a lot of great people there that night. And the statue isn't far from where he dropped dead in the last 2 minutes of a game between the two teams, ironically, he used to own. But I said that night, I said, I want you to all know that basically, if it wasn't for Frances Upton, you wouldn't know Burt Bell. You would know him at Penn. You would know him, you know, you would know his father, who, by the way, his father was second in seniority on the Walter Camp Rules Committee. And his father helped negotiate with Teddy Roosevelt to save college football. So I know I'm jumping around, but the story about...
No, you're good. You're good.
The story about her and the story about how they got together. Now, the Ziegfeld Follies had a rule that you had to get Flo Ziegfeld's permission to get married and even to smoke, but to get married. They got secretly married.
Yeah.
And actually, when she came to Philadelphia, she gave him the check to buy what became the Philadelphia Eagles. On their way back, after buying the team out of bankruptcy, they looked up on a big board up there, a big billboard, and up on it, it said, the National Recovery Act American Eagle. And he said, there's the name of the team, the Philadelphia Eagles. I mean, stranger than fiction, but that's the way things happened then. So that from there, then the Eagles, they survived for a while. But in a meeting in Pittsburgh, where the draft will be the next week,
yeah,
which has now become a national phenomenon. Little did
Burt Bell. It's almost a national holiday. It's getting there.
Yeah, it is. I think it's the third most televised event of them all. So anyway, he went. The team was bad. You know, he founded them in 1933. By 1935, he saw 20 teams had already, Greg, gone out of business. So he saw what was happening. And so at the league meeting in Pittsburgh, he said, I'm one of the worst. He said, I can't afford the players that I want to sign. And there are a lot of other of us in this room that can't either.
That would have been the Rooneys and the Bidwells. Well, the not the Bidwells, but the Cardinals and at the time.
Bears, the Giants, and believe it or not, the Green Bay Packers, they all made money. And he said, if I am your weakest link, and unless I'm paraphrasing, unless we do something, we're going to go out of business.
Right.
And so he convinced them. Ironically, this weekend, or next weekend, it's going to be one of the biggest televised events, and they're predicting up to 80,000 people will be there on opening night. So God bless Burt Bell, because I guarantee you there would be no football.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I agree 100%.
So that's basically what happened. So anyway, just a little backstory about what it was like then. By the way, my mother, her roommate, speaking about Chicago again, your hometown.
Yeah.
Her roommate was Ruth Etting. Now, how many people in Chicago knew Mo the Gimp Snyder? Mo the Gimp Snyder, the movie Love Me or Leave Me with Doris Day and Jimmy Cagney, the true story of Mo the Gimp Snyder and his love affair with Ruth Etting, who he then married, even though it broke up. Ruth Etting's roommate was Frances Upton. And they went to Chicago many times. But they both used to sleep with guns under their pillows for fear that Mo the Gimp Snyder, who was so jealous of her, that they feared that he would come in and start shooting them. True story.
Wow.
It's in my book.
Wow.
Well, one night, Ruth says to him, Mo wants us to go to a party, ready for this, for Al Capone. And so my mother, a little naive, huh?
Yeah.
She goes to the party, and she's right at kind of across. All of the people, the non-gangsters, were sitting with their backs to the door. Guess why? And all of Capone and his people were sitting with their backs against the wall. And so finally my mother kicks Ruth Etting and said, why are we sitting with our backs to the door? She whispered to her, she said, because if they come in to kill Capone or any of his people, they're going to shoot us first. So that was her experience, and she had many experiences. My mother did as much as my father in the world of show business, movies. She went out and made two movies. Hollywood didn't like it, came back again. But her life, and people write about her in many of the books, but I've always said her life should be done, both as a movie and as a book, because she was a fascinating character. She knew everybody. She dealt with everybody. She lived in a glamorous world, in many ways much more glamorous than my father, but still, just another story.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Wow. Well, you're talking about your book. There's a lot of that in that. It's been many years since I've read your book. So as you're telling me all this, like, yeah, I do remember that. I do remember. I mean, yeah. In your book, you literally lay everything. The first, couple chapters, it's about your family, about your parents.
Well, and for people who are historians in your audience, if you get the book, because not only did my father invent the draft, but he had one of the most famous quotes that's still used today, and actually my brother protected it for a while till he died legally. My father was the one that coined the phrase "on any given Sunday," and then the rest of it was any team can beat any other team. He gave it, I think, in 1955. He was called by a member of the AP or United Press and said, "Bert, you're making up the schedule. How do you do it?" And he said, "Well, I schedule the week against the week, sound like the NFL today. I schedule the week against the week and the strong against the strong. So by midseason, on any given Sunday, any team can beat any other team." That was the Burt Bell immortal quote, among any.
Yeah, and that did spawn the name of a great football movie, too. on any given Sunday.
but they couldn't. My brother blocked it.
That explains it.
It just says any given Sunday.
Not on any given Sunday.
Can't say it because legally, we would have sued them. And the NFL was very careful with it too. They didn't want it because it's the movie is really about a lot of things the NFL at that time. Today it'd be great.
Oh yeah.
That time they didn't with gambling and everything else like that. So
well that clears it up. I know the movie Any Given Sunday was shown here in Japan, came here to Japan because I've got the movie poster for it. So that clears it up. No, and I know the NFL they wanted nothing to do with that movie, though, some of the greats in the NFL were in that movie. Y.A. Tittle and Johnny Unitas.
Lawrence Taylor was in it too, I believe. But just back for a second, if you get Bob Lyons, who was the head of the Associated Press in Philadelphia, wrote Burt Bell's life story. But
I've read that book. Yeah, it's a great book.
It's a terrific book because he doesn't waste any emotion. He just lays it out one after the other. Of Burt Bell's life from the very beginning. Another thing maybe your audience doesn't know who haven't read the book, that Burt Bell volunteered along with John B. Kelly, Grace Kelly's father, and they became lifetime friends. They volunteered for service. I mean, people are trying to duck it today, but they volunteered and went to France in the First World War. And my father was actually cited for bravery in the field by General Pershing. I mean, he had an incredible life. They both did, my mother and father.
Yeah. Well, wow. And on that note, so have you. I mean, after your dad unfortunately passed away at the Pittsburgh Eagles game at Franklin Field, but your life itself has been. I mean, again, your book says it all. You were present at the creation, but you yourself, you've lived such an awesome professional life, not only as a sports executive, but also as a media personality there in Boston. Let's talk about, the one person who I think was very instrumental to your success was Carol Rosenbluth.
No question, because when somebody dies, it's a little bit different. Somebody called me the other day and said, would you consider yourself a Nepo baby, which means, you're the son or daughter of a famous person, therefore. And I reminded the person, I said, you can say what you want. I really don't care one way or another. I said, but my father was dead for almost a year, actually over a year. And Carol Rosenbluth, he going all the way back with Rosenbluth, who was this brilliant guy, hired some of the best football people that went on to have great careers. But there was the other side of him, the gambling, all of the other things about him. Very mysterious man. But going back to how I ended up with the Baltimore Colts is Carol Rosenbluth was a very good running back at the University of Pennsylvania, where my father coached, was an assistant coach on the same coaching staff with the Heisman Trophy person, John Heisman, who was the head coach. And so Rosenbluth and another player by the name of Marty Brillen had enough. They were pissed off, and they decided that they were going to go someplace else. Well, Marty Brillen did go to Notre Dame and came back a year or two later and, beat the hell out of Penn. But my father went to Rosenbluth and he said, listen, your business is in Baltimore. Your father is there. You've got your family business. You can go to Notre Dame, but you won't be as big at Notre Dame as you'll be at Penn. So we talked him into staying. And finally, when the Colts, who had failed, now they came in with the merger that my father arranged between the old All-America Conference and the NFL was the Browns, it was the 49ers, and it was the Colts. But they failed the first time around. And my father wanted to bring them back to Baltimore. So he chose Rosenblum, who in the beginning said, you know what? I have no interest, Bert. Pro football is going nowhere. Ha, ha, ha. Pro football is going nowhere. It's a bad investment. I have no interest. And he said, let me remind you again, the teams are building. We've got the league really going now. But also the other reason why he picked Rosenblum and why he went back to Baltimore, the city of Baltimore had sued the NFL, saying that they unfairly avoided them. And the last time they were in, they never really had a chance. Now, the lawyer for the city of Baltimore was a guy by the name of Bill McMillan. Bill McMillan was the famous lawyer in the Whitaker Chambers case and Alfred Hess. So he was so famous in America at the time, they got him. And he threatened to sue my father, and my father went back and forth with him and everything else like that. And he said, all right, if you sell 15,000 season tickets, I'll agree to bring the team back to Baltimore. They sold it like that. And that's when my father said, I better find an owner. And that's how he got Rosenblum. Rosenblum in the beginning didn't want any part of it. Once he got it, and after a period of years, of course, he was friendly with the Kennedys. I mean, yeah. Greg, it was truly Camelot. I had the best job on earth. I went there in the summer of 1960 and then came back after college in 61, started out in the ticket office because in those days, that's where the money was. Right. You know, TV was good, yeah, but nothing TV wasn't, like that.
TV wasn't but what it is today.
One of my best jobs was on a Friday, Rosenblum would call the ticket office and say, get Uppy, get him the Colt wagon. I need him to go to the White House. I used to go to the White House all the time, take footballs over, sneakers over. You know, they have touch football on the lawn.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Well, not only that, after the championship and the sudden death game in 58 and then in 59, Rosenblum was very close with Joe Kennedy. You can like Joe Kennedy or dislike him, whatever it was, but two power brokers. Rosenblum had his own private plane. He used to fly the players to Hyannis to play Unitas, Gino Marchetti, I think Big Daddy Lipscomb a couple of times. He would fly them there, and they would be in the touch football games. And some of the players had great stories. One time, I don't know if it was Gino or somebody said, yeah, we get in the huddle. I'm not sure that any of the Kennedys knew who the hell we were. Probably they did. And Bobby Kennedy's telling Unitas what to do. And he said, I said, I'm not surprised Bobby Kennedy told everybody what to do.
Yeah.
But that was the relationship. They were bigger than life after that sudden death game, which changed America and I believe started pro football on its real rise. And by the way, Bert Bell was the one that put the rule in when he said at the owners' meeting 3 or 4 years before that, he said, what the hell happens if a championship game ends up in a tie? He said, who's number one? Because the All-Star game was the biggest game at that time for the NFL.
Yeah.
So who's going to play the All-Star game? Well, he said, how ridiculous are we going to look? Flip me a coin. So the owner said, well, what do you want to do? He said, we're going to play an overtime, but we're going to call it sudden death, and we're going to play till the first score. That was it, unlike all the crap that you see today.
Yeah.
So again, long story short, Rosenblum, 58, well, he came back in either 56 or 57. 58, repeat champion, and 59, one of the greatest teams of their time, the legendary Unitas. I mean, he had it all going for him. The Kennedys, I mean, every Sunday was a big day, not only because of the game, sellouts, the craziness of Baltimore, their own marching band, but which Kennedy was going to show up, who was going to be in the press box, would it be Pierre Salinger, private presidential box. It was an amazing time, a lot different from today, where a lot of it today, listen, I enjoy it, but it's manufactured bullshit. You know? Pardon my language, but that,
oh, that's okay. I agree. I agree 100% with you.
That's okay. I mean, everybody's out promoting. Then real people came. Not that you don't have your celebrities today. There was a time when we were in the LA airport, and Clark Gable happened to be there, you know, the king of cinema of those times.
Yeah.
Who would he be today? Bigger than Tom Cruise, bigger than Newman or anybody.
Yeah.
So we're in there, and Unitas was a fascinating guy in that he didn't have much to say off the field. He wasn't a big bullshitter. He was, you know what I mean? He was a guy that you liked. The players really liked him. Clark Gable walks across when he finds out the Colt team, or, you know, we're getting off the, and in the airport, getting off the flight out there. Gable walks across, and probably the only time I've really seen a Hollywood star other than the phony shit that goes on today. And he said, "I want to shake hands with the greatest football player in America." And Giannis shook hands with him, kind of smiled, didn't say a lot. But he was kind of the quiet type of hero that you would like today. There was nothing complicated about him. But he was very complex and complicated when you got on the football field. Only Tom Brady could probably match him, and maybe not totally, for brilliance of understanding. He was the Einstein, Shakespeare, you name it, of football. The first to start, you know, the 2-minute drill, which was in the championship game, the check off at the line of scrimmage before everybody else. He also 40 some games in a row, which finally was broken 50 some years later. And now, because there are extra games, then there was only 12, then 14. 47 games, I believe, in a row, Greg, he threw one or two touchdown passes. You'll never see it again.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I was born in what, the late 60s, so I never got to see Johnny Unitas play.
Unbelievable.
But everything that I've seen and everything that I've read about Johnny Unitas, again, like you said, he's a very complex man. But in terms of talent, and yeah, I would say, I mean, there's an aspect about 1960s and 70s football about the toughness. And he was as tough as they came.
Well, he not only was that, in the beginning of the 60s, you know, the rule hadn't been put in yet. Now you can't touch the passer.
Right.
As you know, you can't touch the receiver. But basically then you could hit the quarterback after the play.
Yeah.
And I first couple of years, I worked on the field during the game. And during the games, and I can tell you, it was mayhem. What was going on, and you could hit the quarterback after the play. And there was one particular play where they were playing the Bears, and of course the Bears had gouged your eyes out.
Yeah.
And you know what? Not that much has changed today, but I mean, that was the Bears, a kick you in the head to do anything. That was Hallis. That's why they were the monsters of the Midway, at least in those times. And I think it was Doug Atkins or somebody had hit Unitas and his face was bleeding. And of course he would never let on to anything. So the officials said, "Johnny, if you want a few more minutes to kind of compose yourself," and I said, "F you, blow the goddamn whistle." That was it. And you know what? The next play, he threw a 50-yard touchdown pass. We beat the Bears. See you later.
And this was back in the day, too, when, you know, talking about toughness. I mean, all these teams, I mean, the Colts, the Bears, everybody was playing pretty much on a dirt infield in a baseball park too.
Well, yeah, because you had to share your stadiums.
Yeah.
With baseball stadiums, and baseball ruled the roost for much of that time. No longer true today.
Right.
But there was no question. I will tell you this, and I'll share it with your audience because it'll probably be 2 years maybe before it's out. Talking about famous people. I got an email and then a call. Do you remember Candid Camera? Anybody?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Alan Funt.
Alan Funt's Candid Camera.
His son called me. His son is still doing the old Candid Camera on YouTube.
Oh, wow. Really?
But his son has decided, he's written for everybody. He's written for the Times. As a freelancer for a lot of different people. He's going to be doing a book on the fabulous 60s of the NFL and wanted to talk to me about Burt Bell and about the league and what it's like. And I said, the 60s, I've done one long interview with him. I'll do some more. He's researching all over the place. And I said, the 60s were the last time you had real NFL football. Really the way it was. It's totally different today. You know, it's an outside game.
Yeah.
Guys, I can remember one time Jim Taylor making a cut. We're playing when they had the Packers had the great teams during the 60s, and we're playing. It was Jimmy Taylor and Paul Hornung and, of course, Bart Starr. And Taylor breaks through the line of scrimmage, and guys are piling on him. He actually grabbed the guy's leg and bit into the leg. It's a blood spurter. Spurting it up and going like, Jesus, unbelievable. But that was the game then. It was personal. And I'm not advocating and saying the 40s or the 50s or the 60s or 70s were better than today. They're two completely different games. One you can enjoy then. You can enjoy what you see now, if
right.
you like it or don't. But then it was war. No, nobody thought, well, Jesus Christ, if I'm going to make, I got to be careful because I might make $40 million next year. These guys, probably the best, I think Unitas made the best in his career, probably
$25,000. Okay, yeah.
But the money, once that whistle blew and that game was on, nobody was thinking about money. Nobody was thinking about their future contract. Nobody was thinking, Jesus, if I get hurt, I better protect myself.
Right.
It was, I hate to say it, but it really was some facsimile of war.
Yeah. I mean, everything that I've read, and obviously I think you know me well enough. I'm a huge NFL films fan of that era. And, you know, you watch the game film and you just see the hits, the shots, everybody. I mean, now the players back then were smaller and maybe slower than they are today. However, the rules were so completely different. You could take a shot. I mean, I'm sure, well, Joe Namath, to hear stories about him talking about playing. I mean, it's amazing he's still walking after all these years.
And I will say that some of the players were smaller, but somebody like Dick Butkus, he was a big man. Big Daddy Lipscomb played for us. He was 6'6". He was probably 285, 290. There were guys that were very big, and then there were guys that weren't there that big. I mean, like today, you're approaching up to 400 pounds, and I just really wonder what damage is it doing to the players then. I mean, when I first started to watch it and go to training camps as a kid, you had leather helmets. And then Paul Brown brought in, you know, the harder helmet, and then it graduated from there. Now going back to what they try to get these big outgrowths on a helmet. But you know what? Today, then you had concussions, nothing near what you had today. The plastic helmet changed everything. But today, I just finished doing something on Unvarnished Football with people and some I know because they're here in Boston. An NFL player today is four times likely to get CTE. That would not have happened years ago because the size was smaller. The hits were just as explosive, but the game was different. Now, you didn't use your head, number one, even though the kickoff was dangerous and there were so many other things. There weren't a lot of players then, unless we didn't know it, wasn't aware of it. A lot of players that I knew lived in their 60s, 70s, 80s. They weren't wounded like these guys are now.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the natural progression of the game.
Yeah. Well, with the natural progression of the game came coaching. And when you started with the Colts, Weeb Eubank was –
He was.
So Weeb was the coach of the Colts.
Correct.
And so you started off with Weeb, and then you graduated and went to Don Shula. What were those two guys like? Because I've read books about both, and they both, to me, just seem like very fascinating characters.
Completely
on opposite ends of the spectrum. But you had relationship. I mean, you were friend. You knew both guys. So what can you tell me about them?
Well, let me take you back, because Weeb came from the Paul Brown coaching staff.
Right.
Let me take you back to 1950, right after the merger between the NFL and the old All-America Conference. And so my father, my brother, and myself were going to spend a week or a few days at least at the Cleveland Browns training camp. And in my book, I have Paul Brown as the greatest coach of all time. And the reason I do is, let me start with that week. It's the first time I saw film study. It's the first time I saw the team eat together. It's the first time I saw a team. And I watch all the practices at Hiram College in Hiram, Ohio. Film study, IQ test, 40-yard dash. Team stays with together the night before the game at a hotel or motel. Great regiment, great intelligence. I remember saying to my father at the end of the week or 3 or 4 days, I said to my father, I think that the Browns will beat the shit out of the Eagles. And my father said, shut up, Upton. Don't say a word. Don't say anything to a reporter, nothing. He said, I'm going to praise the Browns, but that they're good for football, and which was a big thing.
Yeah.
As big as, in some ways, as the merger between the NFL and the old AFL of Lamar Hunt. But I knew it. I kept my mouth shut. Opening game, I think they had 50,000. They moved the game from Shy Park to Municipal Stadium. And the Browns beat the hell out of them. I mean, it wasn't even close. The Eagles were the champions.
This was the first time where it was truly a world championship game, because you had the Browns of the new league versus the Eagles of the old league, and you know everybody was shocked except those who you and everybody who knew who the Cleveland Browns were.
Today, you still have an IQ test. In fact, I gave it. It's not really an IQ test. It's called the Wunderlich test. I don't know whether they still use it now, but we used it all the way through when I was head scout of the Colts. We have the 40-yard dash. They do that at the combine in Indianapolis. I'm going like, Jesus. I saw that before God was created woman. You know, that this was Paul Brown. Everything that you see today was Paul Brown. He was so far ahead of everybody. Not a particularly likable guy, but it didn't make any difference. He was the one that did it. So out of that came Weeb Eubank. And by the way, Brown never wanted his coaches to leave. I mean, he would do everything to make sure that they couldn't leave. But Weeb Eubank was a tactician. He wasn't particularly. He was the exact opposite of, they used to call him the little professor of Shula, who was boom, boom, boom. And so he developed Unitas. He did a lot of different things, but like everything else, sooner or later, the team got older and it was time to move on. And Rosenblum was not somebody, he loved his coaches, but the minute that he saw something, he was moving on. So they called him the little professor. And I learned a lot of things sitting in and watching him watch film and talking to his coaches and his meetings with players and everything that he did. And, you know, he kind of had the old time kind of not shorts, but the old time kind of college coaching outfit. I mean, everything that you looked at, you say, that's Newt Rockne. That's not with the bravado, but that's the way he dresses, the way he talks, and things like that.
Yeah.
So the change from him after Rosenblum had fired him, ironically, he's going to come back and beat us in the biggest game that changed everything.
Yeah.
Because he knew us so well.
Yeah.
In comes Shula, and I knew right away, and he and I were friends to the end of his life. But he came in, he was tough, he's bombastic, he was very smart. He knew the game defensively, but he knew what an offense must be. But I said right away, this is going to be a clash between Weeb or between Shula and Unitas. You could see it because Unitas didn't. Weeb had Unitas kind of prepare the game plan with him in some ways. He was kind of Unitas's alter ego.
Yeah.
And Unitas, I think, felt like he was losing his father in football. He never said that. But with Shula was very confrontational. Run the goddamn play again. Do this, do that. Now, this was a young 33-year-old Don Shula.
Mm-hmm.
And so the clash started from the very beginning when Shula came in and really lasted to the very end in some ways, unfortunately. But Shula, I could see, he was a brilliant guy that really knew how to adjust to every kind of situation. His biggest mistake in life at that time was, I remember getting on the bus the day of the 1968 Super Bowl game, Broadway Joe, who was, you know, constantly on Lou Michaels, on a lot of our team, bragging at the swimming pool, I guarantee a victory with the beautiful women. All that bullshit. But I think I said earlier in the week to one of our coaches, maybe even Shula, I said, we got to be careful here. I think, and you can tell when something is going on in the locker room around the team. I said, I think we have to be a little careful here because I think our players are taking, I think they're taking the Jets too lightly. And so, we're getting on the bus that day, and I was sitting there, Jimmy Orr, who was a great receiver for us, very, very funny, very, very, very kind of Southern humor and everything else. And he said to me or to somebody, Senor, I hope Earl Morrow never wakes up today. And of course he did wake up, and Shula didn't take him out fast enough. In the second half, he should. I would have probably taken him out at the end of the first half. And even though Unitas still couldn't throw the football as well as he could, I felt like if you interject Unitas, and he did once he got in there late in the third quarter, he did drive us to a touchdown, but then threw an interception because the arm wasn't good anymore.
Right.
But I felt if he did put him in and we come back and win the game, Shula still would be there. He wouldn't be on Miami and the world wouldn't have changed the way it did. All it just shows you is one game, one bad decision. The owner turns on you. He's pissed off. He and Shula don't talk again. And Unitas and he never really did. So
yeah.
It quickly changes like that.
Right. And then, of course, Shula goes to the Dolphins and then grabs Earl Morrill, and Morrill helps, you know.
But what he did, he was smart. In the playoff game against Pittsburgh.
Yeah. This was in the perfect season, 1972 AFC Championship game. Miami was at Pittsburgh in that game.
And what he did is he learned his lesson. Greasy had been hurt for six games or so.
Yeah.
But in spite of that, Earl wasn't doing that well, and the Steelers were dominating. And this time, he probably thought to himself, no matter whether he admitted it or not, I can't do this again. And he pulled Earl, put Greasy in, fake kickoff by Rick Seipel, They get the ball down there, they go in, and they beat the Steelers. Of course, the Steelers then totally dominated later on. Shula won back-to-back, never went back, or went one more time with Marino, but never went back. The Steelers totally dominate. And what was it? With his ex-coach, who was a very close friend of mine too, Chuck
Norris. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So, you know, because when I was listing out all our I had a whole bunch of topics I wanted to go over with you, and we're getting through that. So the next topic I wanted to ask you about, something near and dear to my heart, is the city of Chicago and the NFL. And you've spent a lot of time both at Wrigley and also, I would have got to assume, at Comiskey Park too, seeing the Cardinals too.
The biggest game, Bert Bell became commissioner in 1946. My first trip to Chicago with my father. My father says, the two Bell kids, you're going out with George Halas, you're going to training camp. Ironically, again, we go out with Shorty Ray for the first week. Shorty Ray, who's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame now, was the head of officials. What my brother and I didn't know is, get this, he was colorblind. And so he was driving the car, and we are dying in the back seat because he's running every green light, or he's running every red light and stopping for every green light. I'm going like, holy shit, this guy's the head of officials, and he's colorblind. I don't think anybody ever knew it. But anyway, we get to the Bears camp. And one thing I can say about George Halas, well, a lot of things I can say about it, is that the week I spent at training camp, my brother and myself, you know, I was 9 years old. I've never considered myself a child or a kid. I was born and around football players my whole life. Yeah. Around athletes, celebrities. You know what? You keep your toys. I'm going to training camp. And George Halas had one of the great staffs at that time. Hunk Anderson. Who else? Patty Driscoll, who's in the Hall of Fame now, was on his. And Luke Johnsos. Great coaching staff. They had meetings every night. Halas made sure that the Bell kids could come in and sit and watch his meetings. Now, how many 9-year-old kids anywhere would a coach invite in today for his meeting? I learned more in those meetings. I watched them diagram up on the chalkboard. I could see what happened, what was going on. Sid Luckman was the quarterback, George McAfee, both of them in the Hall of Fame. Ken Cavanaugh was the fullback, but I could see the beginnings because they got together with Clark Shaughnessy later on. I could see the beginnings of the flanker. They had decided that they were going to take because it was the fullback, left halfback, and right halfback, full backfield, which you'll never see again.
Right.
They had decided they're going to break off one and make him a receiver. Today, that third person, that third running back, and now even the other one, is a wide receiver, flanker, whatever you want to call them. So I could see things and saw through that training camp. And think about all those players eventually in the Hall of Fame. Sid Luckman, Ed Sprinkle, a 205-pound defensive end, and I would tell you, he would still scare the shit out of me today. Just a quiet assassin. Loved him. Bulldog Turner. All of the players of that time.
Yeah.
They're really great. And I remember sitting on a tackling dummy one day. And there, I mean, you scrimmaged, you know, twice a day maybe. Today you can't do anything. Yeah, in the one scrimmage, I saw a guy, I think he got knocked out or he's down. And I was sitting on a tackling dummy. And the players, completely different. These are players, many of them in 46 who'd come back from World War II. These were men. These weren't boys with agents.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw me and I was walking out and he put his arm around me and he said, "You know what, kid? This beats killing people." That was the attitude. This was easy compared to fighting in a war where you had to kill somebody. I thought it was so, I think about that. That was 1946. This is 2026. I think about that every day. Wow. I think about, if you ask me how to describe the players, and I wish the people who are listening and watching this would appreciate the love that you have of a player. Today it's a totally different thing, and I understand that.
Right. But
these are people who saw death. These are people who came back. They didn't have a chip on their shoulder. If you said to them, "You're going to make $7,000 a year," you know what they say? Thank you.
Yeah.
Now, we've gone from that to where the player shouldn't be treated like cattle completely. I mean, that's
right.
A completely different thing. The other thing I want to tell you is that, and this is really a warning sign today, in 1946, the average life of a pro football player in the NFL, smaller, I mean, 3.5 years. You know what it is today? The same. Nothing has changed. They train year-round. They get the best food. They got their gurus. They're bigger, stronger, quicker, faster. But the bottom line is like somebody saying, "You're born then, and you're going to die here." That hasn't changed. Same.
I didn't realize that the career expectancy is only still 3.5 years.
Still. I study all the crap, and I can tell you that now there's a reason for it.
Right.
And of course, quicker, bigger, stronger, quicker, faster. The hits are unbelievable.
Yeah.
You can't beat on somebody like that. The other part of it, and we can move on, is at that time I knew as a kid, and it would never happen today. Look at the whole thing that's going on with Mike Vrabel and the reporter and their meeting or whatever happened there. I mean, it is front page news everywhere. People are fighting about it and you name it, what's going on there. It's a free for all.
Yeah, I can imagine the papers in Boston, the news in Boston.
People from ESPN, everywhere, yeah. Attacking each other. Well, why didn't Diana Rossini, what was going on here? She blah, 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 this and that. But here's a bigger story. There's a book out now that you should get, and she could get the author on, called, I think it's called Leave It to Sid. It's The Life of Sid Luckman. And I knew it would be front page news everywhere. I knew that his father was in jail for murdering someone. And so did the Chicago media.
Yeah.
But unlike now, they had so much respect for Sid, who, I'll tell you what, a sweet, if you ask me to define one player, and I've known a lot of great ones, if you ask me to define one player that I felt like, boy, who wouldn't love this guy?
Yeah.
It would be Sid Luckman. Out of respect to him, the story is now told in this book. Out of respect, nobody wrote it. And everybody knew it. And the lengths that they went to try to keep it out, keep it away from people.
Right.
Because again, the other implication is, remember, that same year in 1946, Burt Bell really, he saved the NFL two or three different times. Mm-hmm. But 1946, the same Chicago Bears, Sid Luckman, are playing the New York Football Giants in New York at the Polo Grounds. Day before the game, my father usually take the train, go to New York. They that night they, you know, they have the press in and the media and everything. Yeah. And so he got a call from the district attorney's office and the governor and said,
"Oh yeah, yeah, I know this story. Bell, yeah.
This is Frank Hogan, district attorney. Two of the New York Giants players have been offered bribes. They didn't take them. They didn't think they took them, but never reported them. And therefore, we need you to come to New York, and we need to bring the two players in. One was the quarterback, Frankie Filchak, and the other one was Merrill Hapes, the running back. And they spent all night there discussing what to do. My father finally said, we've got to let Filchak play because he's the quarterback in the game. We'll be watching. Hapes, he suspended and eventually for life.
Yeah.
And the very next day he came out and announced it. He didn't hide it, which people tend to do. He said, this is what happened. And he completely cut off any problem that the NFL was involved with gambling. And from that day forward, until unfortunately the last 5 or 6 years, the first thing he did is he called his ex-quarterback, Davey O'Brien, who played for him at the Eagles, who had left the mm-hmm. Eagles at the height of his career to join the FBI and was considered under J. Edgar Hoover the best pistol shot in America. He called him and said, can you get me ex-FBI, retired FBI people in every city so I can begin to follow all of these different leads and see what happens? And the other thing he did was he contacted gamblers that he knew from way, way in his past and said, I want you starting on Sunday, right after all the games are finished, to call me and give me the up and coming week odds. And he said, if there's any fluctuation, he actually called, he might have called Hallis one time. He would call into the locker room on a Sunday morning and saying, what the hell is going on here? There's a different point spread. But he knew there was a phone at home where he would take calls from these three fabulous characters. I never met them, never knew them. Hockey Wingy and Frisco Legs. How are those for names? And he had another guy, Footsie Stein, that ran a restaurant in Philadelphia. He would go in and get those odds all week long. He, not only that, the other thing that's still around today is that he basically said every team by Thursday must report who was injured and who isn't and who's probable for the game. That's still around 46 to today. That's still around from 60, 70 years ago.
Wow.
So that's how close the game came to really going down the tubes.
Yeah. Yeah. And really, I mean, and the weird thing, what would your dad think if he saw where we're at now with,
he would not be for it. He would not like it. But I will tell you this. I blame the Supreme Court for this crap.
Right.
Because they gave everybody an excuse to do it. Now, when I turn on the TV, I turn the sound down for every game, hockey, basketball, baseball, because the fix is in. And now, I mean, the announcers at ESPN, they're all doing it. Bet MGM, bet this, DraftKings, brought to you by this and by that.
Yeah.
He would die over this. Because I guarantee you this, Greg, there will be more than one. We saw what happened in baseball. with the Indians and tipping your pitches and all like that. There will be an NFL scandal, but it's too late.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we wrap everything up, there's two individuals in American sports history that I don't think we've ever really talked about. And to wrap everything up, so the two of them are Vince Lombardi and Howard Cosell.
Howard Cosell walk into me and say, that young Upton Bell, brilliant guy, really some praise to the high heavens, but he hasn't done a goddamn thing for the Patriots. And he's walking away, baby. I knew Cosell. I'm in his book. Cosell changed, like him or not,
right?
Changed sports forever. Every person out there shooting their mouth off on television and radio should thank Howard Cosell because his classics with Muhammad Ali. Again, Ali, I used to interview all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Cosell, get rid of that rug. I mean, he was, you think about those people, but we'll start with Cosell. He really changed broadcasting. He called people out. Monday Night Football, even if the game stunk, didn't you want to hear what he and Dandy Don made Meredith had to say? I mean, it was, you couldn't manufacture that. But he was the first one to call out the jockocracy in America today is out of bounds. I mean, what can I say about the guy? I don't care whether people liked him or not. He brought show business to it. He brought a frankness to it. Unfortunately, he got involved in the boxing thing and it really kind of screwed him up. I actually interviewed him a couple months before he died. And he was very, very, I probably, I would say, Greg, the other part of my life, I would say combination of sports, politics and books, I probably interviewed pretty near 1,000 people from every walk of life.
Yeah.
And at the end of his life, Rune Arledge had kind of pushed him aside, put his office in the back. I went down to ABC to interview him. That interview is out there somewhere where he talked about how he was being treated now, and Rune never appreciated everything he did. I was very sad to see that happen. But Cosell was incredible. Now, Lombardi is another story, because when Pride Mattered, the book that came out on his life.
Great book, yeah. That is one of the, there's a lot of great football books out there, and that would be in my top 10.
Well, right? And it was a great book, and he is a great writer. And
Dave Manassas.
Yeah. But Moranis also wrote a book on Jim Thorpe. Get it? One of the great books about America that you've ever read.
Hmm.
But anyway, I set up to interview him.
Yeah.
And I told him, I'll tell you what, you got wrong in your story. And I want to correct it again tonight on your show. After the Giants championship run, but particularly after the 58 game and then the 59 game, Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry. Tom Landry was going to go to Dallas. My father called Tim Mara, who was still alive at that time, the owner. And he said, Tim, Green Bay is failing. He said, I need to do something. Now, 3 years before that, and you can look this up too, because there's, you see it from time to time, the film on it. 3 years earlier, the Packers again were going to go under. And my father called CBS and Tex Schramm, who had left the Rams, to go to CBS.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Tex, he said, they're in trouble. I need to build a new stadium. He said, can you lend us the money that I need to build this new stadium? One going to be fancy. And Schramm said, I won't only lend it to you, I'll give it to you. I think it was like $300,000.
Yeah.
They built the stadium, which saved, my father saved the Packers twice. The first time they built the stadium, and there's, it's out there on old NFL films. It's Burt Bell giving the address on TV to talking about, this is the greatest day, I'm paraphrasing it, this is the greatest day, ladies and gentlemen, for the Green Bay Packers. Right next to him is Tricky Dick Nixon, who had come there for the dedication. Moving on to Lombardi as part of it. Two or three years later, my father called Tim Murray and said, Tim, look, Green Bay's in trouble again. They're not doing it. And it's the only real small town franchise. We got to save it. So he said, I would like you to give me permission to move Lombardi from you, because they loved Lombardi. Lombardi was going to be there after Jim Lee Howe. Lombardi, I know they had, they wanted Allie Sherman, but Lombardi was a guy they really wanted. My father said, we need him for Green Bay. Burt Bell was the reason that Lombardi ended up in Green Bay, not all the other crap that you heard about it. And I did, and Moranis said, Upton, I'm sorry, I should have called you about it. But anyway, the story was Wellington Mara did this and did that, and Wellington and I have been great friends, or were. But that changed it. Lombardi was a perfect guy for Green Bay. Taciturn, tough, wouldn't put up with all the bullshit that was going on there, and, you know, just totally turned the thing around. Mm-hmm. And recognized the talent. And one of the biggest things he did was Green Bay, very close society there, and very few African Americans, if any. And one of the first things that he did is bring Emlyn Tunnell from the New York Giants to there at the end of his career. And of course had Willie Wood. But the one thing that he told the players, because of different things, the bars, you know, white bars only and stuff like that. Yeah. Said, we're going to do it together. He said, nobody's going to be left out here. I don't care what your color is. And it really kind of united them. But there were some guys, including Starr in the beginning, that were physically afraid of Lombardi. But he knew how to draft. He knew how to put the team together. I think, although he went then, left when he retired, and then he was general manager. I knew that wasn't going to last long, and then ended up with Washington, with the Redskins. But in that town, in that time, Lombardi was the perfect guy. If Lombardi had gone someplace else, I'm not sure people would have bought it. If he went to Dallas, they'd say, go screw yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
It was the right, my father always had the right feel because he was a player.
Yeah.
He was a coach. He was an owner. Probably no man has ever been more prepared to be commissioner of anything than Burt Bell. And I don't say that as a son, because he's been dead since 1959. I look back now and I study all of the people that are going on and leading things. But you can't, I can't teach you about radio or television. Either you have it or you don't.
Right.
And that's the way that I look at the whole thing. There are certain people that have that. People always ask me, well, why was Burt Bell so successful? I said, well, look at it. He played. He got his, I never knew him when he had all his teeth. He got all his teeth knocked out early. This is a quarterback at Penn. He played, he coached, he understood the play. The even the owners accepted him, even when he ruled against them. He said, I'm going to recognize the Players Association back in the 50s. And they said, over our dead body. And he said, well, I'm going to do it. And he came home and said, I expect to be fired. They never fired him. They ripped up his contract and gave him another 10 years because they admired somebody who stood up to them.
Yeah.
So One last story about the Cardinals.
All right.
1947. Chicago, the Bears, then to the Cardinals camp, and then to Green Bay with Curly Lambeau, who is one of the great characters of all time. And then we were going out to the West Coast for the first time. And I remember the first day of training camp, the Cardinals. And this young guy came walking in, and I felt like this guy has been around forever. Just the way he was unassuming, wasn't pushing himself. Just it's almost like this guy's been playing for 10 years. That player was Charlie Turpie. And like Sid Luckman, you liked him from the very beginning. The minute he put the pads on, boom, he was gone.
Yeah.
And that backfield was one of the great backfields. So the Bears and the Cardinals, back to the beginning, were competing all the time. But look at it back to back. The Cardinals played in two championship games, 47-48. Bears win in 46. It was all Chicago, buddy.
Yeah, it'd be nice if City of Chicago could recapture that football magic.
I don't know.
I hope so. I hope so.
85 Bears were the single, for 1 year, greatest defensive team I've ever seen, and I've seen them all.
Yeah, well, that's true. You have seen it all. And on that note, before we wrap up.
Bye-bye, right?
No. We're not saying bye-bye. No, we're not saying bye-bye yet. Where can people find all of your, you know, I mean, you've got an archive of interviews out there. I mean, I'm not sugarcoating it here, but you are the elder statesman, really, of the NFL in terms of the history. You know everybody. You've met everybody. You've seen everything. But there's a lot of great interviews out there with you, including a couple of mine that I've done with you. Where can people find everything that is?
Well, there's a lot of different places. The first one is which I started with a historian like you, called Unvarnished Football Inc. or unvarnishedfootball.com. They can go right to the website, and there are six or seven episodes up there already. They run 45 minutes to maybe an hour. They're probably long-winded and everything else, but the whole idea, like you and I are doing, was to take a look at today's different issues, and then, like we're doing right now, what was it like back then? And then it gives the listener who didn't know anything about back then the chance to compare it to today.
Right.
That's one. The UptonBell.com, you can go to the website and get that. I think it's also Upton Bell on YouTube. But the other thing that we're going to eventually have, if you go to the Upton Bell collection, I have two, one at UMass Amherst. It looks at the whole history from the 1885 to today, and basically artifacts. The first football I ever got, the gold, solid gold football, was from George Halas, from the 1946 thing. I've been offered hundreds of thousands of dollars for some of the items in there, but it's also the history, and we found in the UMass Amherst collection letters between my grandmother's father and Abraham Lincoln, written letters.
Oh, wow.
So that's one. The other collection is over 500 authors. Write a book, Greg. Over 500 authors from all around the world, 30 Pulitzer Prize winners, 5 Nobel Prize winners that I've interviewed over 50 years.
Okay.
So that is even. So there are a lot of different places. I will leave you this. The best interview I ever did was with a guy at a computer.
Yeah.
Stephen Hawking.
Really?
All on the black holes of the universe. Wow. And I was lucky enough when he came to Boston to meet him.
Yeah.
And what a genius. To me, the two greats. There was Einstein and Hawking. So
Wow. Well, I appreciate you spending time with me, and hopefully we'll get to do this again sooner rather than later. But for everybody who is listening, you know, all what you just said, I'm going to put in the show liner notes, and your interview is going to be available both on the Gridiron Japan, gridironjapan.jp website, and also at the new gridironamerica.net website. Great. That we're working on. Again, the Gridiron America Radio used to be the From the 55 Yard Line podcast, but we've rebranded, and you know, both podcasts are now on the Sports History Network. So Upton, with all that said, you know, we'll sign off here, but you and I will continue the discussion after we've stopped recording here. But for everybody who is listening, who's tuned in, thank you very much for both watching and because it's going to be available on YouTube too. And as Upton is adjusting his nice old school Eagles cap.
There it is.
But yeah.
That's what it looked like when Bart Bell found them.
Yeah, I wish they would bring that logo back. Sometimes, you know, the marketing, the people with the NFL marketing just don't get it right. Much like the Eagles logo, the Cardinals logo, and I could just go down the list,
they
including
keep
your
changing the uniforms,
including your Patriots too. Yeah. I hate the Elvis, the
flying
Elvis.
Elvises. Believe me.
Yeah, I like the logo. I like the Pat Patriot. I'm still partial to that. And but that's a whole nother discussion that we didn't have time for. Let's talk about the Patriots, you, the World Football League. So hopefully we'll get around to that. Then, you know, like I said, sooner rather than later. But we'll have another episode where you and I sit down and talk about that, because and there's just a lot. I mean, our interview just really kind of scratched the surface. So, but I appreciate, you know, I always appreciate spending time with you, because you know, I learn something new every day. And like I always told, like I've told you before, you're very much a mentor to me that, you know, I like sitting around and I like sitting here and just listening to your stories, because I get so much out of it. And I hope everybody else does too. So
thank you.
You're welcome. And on that note, hey, thank you very much for tuning in, everybody. And again, both the Gridiron Japan Gridiron Japan Radio podcast, Gridiron Japan America podcast, they're both available at gridironjapan.jp and gridironamerica.net. And we'll be talking to you, Dave, Mike, myself, John Gunning, Aaron Ellis on the Japan side of the house, and Mike and Dave on the America, on the American Bureau, as I like to call it. We'll be talking to y'all very, very soon with the start of the X League here in Japan. It's coming up sooner rather than later. And also, too, we got the NFL draft coming up. And yeah, so, all right. Well, on that note, on behalf of Upton and myself, thank you very much for listening. And we'll be talking to you soon. Bye-bye.
This is Johnny Unitas of the Baltimore Colts. Let's go, you Colts.
there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.